Let's begin the first panel. We want to make sure that we begin more or less on time. We're not going to introduce the panelists or the chairs because there's biographies outside. Please pick those up, and when we complete this, we'll put a record of the whole thing, whole conference on the web, including more expansive biographies. Let me say that when we thought about doing this, I decided not to include the nuclear issue because Brookings had done a whole day's panel on the nuclear issue about a year ago. And I wanted to focus on two issues. One is the Indian and American relationship with the rest of Asia. Implicitly, that involves China and Pakistan in particular, but other parts of Asia, not simply East Asia, but West Asia as well. And secondly, the second panel will talk about the relationship of economic policy to strategic policy. I noticed that after the Secretary's first meeting in Delhi a year ago, there was a long list of accomplishments and dialogues, but none were actually strategic. They talked about health, they talked about education, talked about agriculture, and I asked an American official, I said, well, where's the strategy? And they said, well, maybe that'll come. But I think this meeting was certainly quite different in content and tone. And so we will talk about the most important relationship, that is the economic relationship, in a strategic context. Of course, the final panel will look ahead. Where will we be 1 year from now? Let me say that I didn't organize this myself, but Ranjana Khanna, where's Ranjana? Yeah. Right here, rocking right in front of me. She was a partner in this every step of the way, offering ideas about panels, panelists, topics, and so forth, and was of great help in the substantive organization of this panel. And before I forget, Aram Haider, who's my research assistant, also made this possible. So let me introduce Ambassador Lalit Mansingh. Almost everybody is an ambassador. Ambassador Lalit Mansingh and Ambassador Frank Wisner. And they will chair the first panel. Thank you.
Thank you.
If you want to do it, you could do it from sitting down. Whatever you want to do. Yeah, okay, whatever it's comfortable. Okay.
Thank you, Steve, for that introduction. I want to thank Brookings and Fiki for this very unique event, a kind of track two dialogue immediately following the official level discussions. Martin Indyk said we are a parallel dialogue. I want to add to that, apart from being parallel, I think we are a complementary dialogue. And the reason is that while official discussions are held in sanitized surroundings and they come out with politically correct statements, we have no such restraint here. We are a group of scholars, entrepreneurs, analysts, former diplomats, but we don't represent our governments, and therefore we can speak frankly. Let me say that what one has heard from the American leadership in the last couple of days is music to my ears, at least, and I'm sure music to many Indians, because some of us have lived through those dark decades of Indo-US relations when India was declared strategically irrelevant for the United States, when India was declared as a black hole, a basket case, with no hope for the future. So when you hear statements made by the US leadership which contrast with the kind of language used for nearly 50 years after independence, it is indeed an exhilarating experience. I'm going to start with a puzzle. The puzzle is that you take the statements by the leadership on both sides, and then you take statements made by commentators on both sides, and there seems to be a disconnect. Let me explain how. President Obama, and this is a quote from him, considers Indo-US relations as, in his words, one of the defining partnerships of the 21st century. And Undersecretary Burns, who was here this morning, has been giving a series of talks on Indo-US relations. And in his speech at the CFR on the 1st of June, a few days ago, he said, "Never has there been a moment when India and America mattered more to each other, and never has there been a moment when the partnership between India and America mattered more to the rest of the world." Great words. The big puzzle is why there's so much doubt and skepticism about the Obama administration's policies towards India, even though it is spoken of as a strategic partnership. Now, I would understand if these critical comments came from, say, communist intellectuals or Islamic radicals, because their views on the United States are firmly set and no empirical evidence will make them change their mind. But it's people like us who are making these comments, and that's why I'm a little concerned. Let me give you a few samples of the kind of comments which have been made. Two of my former colleagues in the Foreign Service, very distinguished diplomats, have been commenting on this. Two recent articles by my colleague Ambassador G. Parthasarathy in the Wall Street Journal. And listen to the title. One says, "Does Mr. Obama care about India?" Question mark. And his next article, which is more recent, it's called "The Axis of Grudging Cooperation." All right. Ambassador Sybil is here. I don't want to embarrass him, but he will speak to you later. Here is what he wrote. The title is, "What Strategic Ties with the United States?" All right. On the American side, Daniel Twining published a recent article under the title, "Diplomatic Negligence, the Obama Administration Fumbles About Relations with India." "The Politics of Benign Neglect," the title of another article published by Stanley Weiss. And then Professor Sumit Ganguly wrote an article in the Newsweek, and the title is, "America's Wounded Ally, India Annoyed by Obama." What's going on? I mean, why is there such a differing perception? So let me say simply, I don't think it's a trust deficit, something that we claim we have with Pakistan. I think we have a perception deficit with the United States, that people are not looking at the same thing and saying, making the same comment. It's like the six blind men of Hindustan who touched an elephant and described it in different ways. So there needs to be an effort to bridge this perception gap, which I think is what this seminar is going to achieve. Now, quite clearly, the center of gravity is shifting to Asia. We've seen the process happening over the years. It is a fact. It's no longer questioned. And therefore, when we see the subject of our discussion today, I think it's right that Asia has been chosen as the test case for the strategic partnership. And it's rightly so, because in the 21st century, Asia will be the locus of big power conflict and a cooperation. And dealing with the developments in Asia will be the biggest challenge for both India and the United States. The paradox in Asia is that while the continent is going on an economic rise, it is also beset with almost intractable political issues. And these have to be tackled by our two countries. As moderators, we are not supposed to speak on the subject, so I will just outline some of the issues concerning Asia that need to be discussed, and I hope our discussants will pay close attention to them. In my view, there are six separate but interlinked issues in Asia on which currently we have some convergence and a lot of divergence, and therefore we need to focus on these six issues. One, India's neighborhood minus Pakistan. Number two, Pakistan. Number three, Afghanistan. Number four, China. Number five, the Indian Ocean. Number four, Iran. Number five, China. And number five, the Indian Ocean. Why have I identified these issues? Well, when I come to India's neighborhood, I think this is the most successful demonstration of the new coordination that has taken place between India and the United States. I think whether it's Nepal or Bangladesh or Sri Lanka, Indian diplomats, American diplomats have been speaking to each other. The two headquarters have been coordinating their viewpoints. And we have seen pretty consistent policy on both sides. So I don't regard this as an issue, but I want to pose this as a successful example of our cooperation. Pakistan is not such a successful example because Admittedly, we have better coordination with Washington on Pakistan, but we still have huge areas of difference. The questions often asked in India are, does America have a coherent view of what is going to happen in Pakistan, or is it lurching from crisis to crisis and finding ad hoc solutions? President Obama started off by being very critical of the Pakistani military, alleging that the military had taken the Bush administration for a ride. The Pakistani military will be made accountable for the kind of defense supplies it has been receiving in the past. And the Pakistani military will have to accept the leadership of the democratic government, and the Obama administration's efforts will be to strengthen the democratic government in Pakistan. What we are seeing today is a steady reversal of that projected point of view. Today we see Pakistani army receiving its primacy. As we saw in the strategic dialogue with Pakistan in Washington, there were actually two parallel dialogues. The real dialogue was between General Kiani and General Jones and Admiral Mullen and the military on the one side. And the less important dialogue, which was, of course, the object of photo opportunities, the dialogue between the Pakistani foreign minister and the U.S. Secretary of State. Pakistan, we know Pakistan as the source of terrorism in India, but the United States also knows Pakistan as the source of terrorism throughout the world. So why is there that we still have a gap, that when it comes to Pakistan, America talks about or assumes it is dealing with its terrorists, and when it comes to us, we have to deal with our terrorists? In our view, there is no such thing as separate terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda and Taliban and Jaish-e-Mohammed, Lashkar-e-Toiba. They're part of the same franchise. They work together. It is a corporate enterprise. And I think India and the United States have to look at it as one entity, not as separate entities. Now, let me move on to the other issues. Why do I think there is a problem in Afghanistan? There is a real problem. President Obama referred to Afghanistan, Secretary Clinton referred to Afghanistan. But the fact is, India has been patted on the back for a wonderful development aid program in Afghanistan. In every American statement, this is there, appreciation of what India has done. The point is, America has to recognize that Afghanistan is vitally important for India's security interests. And to exclude India from any kind of political solution, to give precedence to the sensitivities of the Pakistani army, which does not want India to be there, grumbles about India's consulates. And then we have people like General Jones or General McChrystal supporting this, that, you know, to make Pakistan happy, let's restrict India's presence. I think the opposite should be encouraged. Get India more involved in this. Get Afghanistan's neighbors involved in it. Because quite clearly, if the withdrawal takes place, it is the neighbors of Afghanistan who have to deal with the emerging situation in Afghanistan. China, like it or not, the Bush administration had a clear-cut view of China. There was a global vision, and there was a certain role for China. I think the present dialogue is missing out on China. I don't know if in private discussions are taking place in China, but there's a state of denial on both sides, as if it's an inconvenient issue, let's not discuss it. China is intruding into our security space in a big way. And it's an odd coincidence that China's behavior towards India has been at its worst in the last 65 odd years, coinciding with the first year of the Obama administration. No cause and effect, but simple fact, this has happened. More strident claims on Indian territory, protests against the Indian Prime Minister visiting the capital of an Indian state. Incredible. More intrusions on the line of actual control. More Chinese presence in the Indian ocean around us. Our security planners are getting nervous about this rush of Chinese interest in our immediate neighborhood, in Nepal, in Bangladesh, in Sri Lanka. Whenever there's a vacuum, the Chinese step in, where we think people should step out, like in Nepal when the internal turmoil is going on. China steps in to assure the king of whatever military supplies he wanted. Finally, that Iran. We have a clear-cut view on Iran's nuclear program, and I would give credit to Dr. Manmohan Singh's government for having taken this very logical, clear-cut view on Iran, in spite of the fact that we've got such a long civilizational link with Iran, and there's a lot of sentimental attachment to Iran. But on the nuclear issue, we are absolutely clear that if Iran is secretly pursuing a nuclear weapons program in violation of its international commitments, we are opposed to it. And we have voted 3 times in the IAEA against Iran. But my message to our American friends is, don't push us too hard. Iran is in our neighborhood. Iran is an important supplier of hydrocarbons for India, which we desperately need. And don't ask us to join you in blanket sanctions against Iran, no commerce, no supplies. We need gas and oil from Iran. It is vital for our economy. And so don't squeeze us too hard on Iran. That would be my message. And finally, on the Indian Ocean, I've referred to the problems we are beginning to face in the Indian Ocean. It is the global commons. It is the most, it's the busiest sea lane of commerce in the world. Through it passes much of the hydrocarbon supplies for the whole of the world. But we are seeing increasingly hostile presence in the Indian Ocean area, more piracy. Chinese naval outposts being built out there, even suggestions from China that maybe they could have a deal with the United States and carve out a Chinese sphere of influence in the Indian Ocean and an American sphere of influence. We need to talk about that. So let me wind up by saying what we see is a great beginning of a strategic dialogue. I think it's quite unprecedented. The kind of effort the American administration has made to reassure India that it is considered important in its global view, I think is very reassuring. The fact that the president himself came to the reception given by Secretary Clinton and spoke there and spoke with great warmth is itself an indication of this kind of importance. But let me point out to some of the problems that I foresee in the approach of the administration today. Unlike, as I said, in the case of the Bush administration, we are not sure if there is any overarching strategic plan for Asia in which India has a place. And I think this needs to be defined because a lot of people are saying, are we there or are we not there? That's one. Secondly, there's a lack of focus issues. Now, I, as ambassador here during 10 years ago when we started the discussions, we went through this phase. The Americans spoke of the future and collaboration, strategic partnership, and so on. And we said, what about the immediate issues? And so we started with a trinity of issues, 3 issues, not 20 issues, not 100 issues, 3 issues. Nuclear, space, and high technology. And then the Americans showed interest in missile defense, so the trinity became a quartet. And that's what we discussed for the 4 years of the first Bush administration, which resulted in the next steps in the strategic partnership, which is the precursor of the strategic dialogue. So I think the administration needs to focus. I know there are 18 different initiatives which have been taken by this administration. I can't find a list of the 18. It is not possible for bureaucracies to manage 18 parallel dialogues in one go. And most of these are initiatives which I would say are in the soft power sector. Women's empowerment, disease control, new technologies in energy. Now, these are fine. I think we should have a close relationship on all these issues. But when governments speak to governments, they have to take up the tough issues. And there is a need for taking up tough issues. And finally, I think there is no big ticket item. You know, the nuclear deal consumed public attention in the first Manmohan Singh administration. When we look at the second phase, which coincides with the Obama administration, what is the big ticket item? What are the priorities in this? Some people say, well, there are no big ticket items. The nuclear deal is over. So I think not. I think there are still big issues which are still there. Security Council reform was alluded to by Secretary Burns and Foreign Secretary Nirupama Rao. But we've been talking about it for years, and we haven't come to any conclusion. Why can't the United States say, yes, we think India is worthy of becoming a member of the Security Council? A major economic project, like the Japanese have, the freight corridor. Second Green Revolution. This was mentioned by the joint statement in July 2005. We're still talking about it. Indian Ocean, education, lots of big-ticket items are still there. I'll stop here, and thank you for reminding me, Steve. I will now invite my co-moderator, Ambassador Frank Wisner, and give the floor to him.
Ladies and gentlemen, let me add just a short word of welcome. Lalit Mansingh has laid out a comprehensive view of the issues that frame the present stage of the U.S.-India debate. Our panel today is going to try to get their hands around the issue of what are our interests? What is the starting point so that we reach and are able to make sensible comment on the conclusions that Lalit has laid out and that need to be addressed? I will just set the stage by saying that I think, finally, the United States and India are coming to a moment in our respective lives when our view of interests are converging. On the American side, our interests are threefold: global, in all of the issues outlined this morning by the Foreign Secretary and by Bill Burns; regional, the questions of Afghanistan, of China, of the threat of Islamic radicalism; economic issues, where our interests converge in promoting the prosperity of our two peoples. I believe, and I contend with all of you this morning, that there is common ground on both sides. The United States cannot pursue its interests in the world without cooperation with India, and India will not achieve her essential interests without cooperation with the United States. But in addition to the question of interests lies a matter of principle. And here, in his recent article, Evan Feigenbaum was right on mark when he said our relationship is not, cannot be transactional, for it is at heart based on matters of principle, a coincidence of views about stability, about the balance of power in Asia and the rest of the world, a coincidence of views on the value of free markets, the rule of law, democracy, and the ordering of our political societies. I believe, therefore, as we set now about in the balance of this morning to address the very real and pertinent issues that Lalit Mansingh has laid out, we need to do so with a fresh appreciation of what ties the two of us together before we sort out the conclusions and strategies of what moves us apart. I ask the panelists who will follow me. First of all, Ken Lieberthal, who will speak to us on China. Second, Gautam Adhikari. And third, Marshall Bhutan. if you would be as brief as possible so that we have time for some questions, focus the discussion on this question of interest, and then as the other panels the rest of the morning go through, we can take on the sharp and pressing issues that Lalit has outlined. Let me ask Ken to come up and take the floor first of all. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's a genuine pleasure to be a part of this outstanding program today. I've been asked to comment briefly on China as a factor in U.S.-Indian relations. That, frankly, is not easy to do. It was easier under the Bush administration because I think President Bush had more of a kind of balance of power notion in the way he looked at the world. So he clearly wanted to expand dramatically our relationship with India, pursued the civilian nuclear agreement with India in part, not in whole, but in part, as a hedge against China, feeling that a strong democratic relationship with democratic India would help to make China behave better as it looked around its periphery. I think, as was commented earlier this morning by Secretary Burns, the Obama administration, which in some ways resembles the Clinton administration, has less of a balance of power notion and more of a community of interests approach to things. And so I think that from the U.S. side, the seeing India as a balancer against China is now clearly attenuated in the way we approach our relationship with India. I think somewhat ironically, my sense is in India that there is some concern now that the U.S. has been seriously weakened by events of the last 2 years. China is really on a roll, and that the U.S. may be now paying, in a sense, too much attention to China, too willing to bend to China's priorities, and therefore India would like to see the U.S. Play a strong superpower role and not give too much deference to China. I will say the U.S., as it looks at China now, sees a country whose cooperation or at least a lack of opposition is crucial for managing major global issues effectively and for U.S. interests, especially in East Asia. And my own sense, just bureaucratically, is that when we make policy toward China, India does not actively figure into that. In other words, the people engaged, you see this reflected even in our Asia Directorate at the National Security Council, which does not include India, and our East Asian Pacific Bureau in the State Department does not include India. And so bureaucratically, you have people who don't build India into the equation as much as many of us would think it should be. So the Indian concern, I think, is that the U.S. Consider India more when thinking about China, but never hyphenate India with China, never deal with India simply as a way to get to China, so to strike that kind of balance. Let me make just a couple of comments about the role I think that China plays in India's policies, because I think you need a textured view of that in order to really seriously discuss India in the China and U.S. relationship. And here I would both agree with what Ambassador Mansingh said, but also add some additional dimensions to it, because I think it's a more complex relationship than the security side. I've been very impressed that in the last year or so, Mansingh has really, to my mind, focused a great deal of effort in India on better understanding China. And you see that in part in the elevation of the National Security Advisor, who is probably India's most prominent specialist on China. We just had Foreign Secretary Rao here, whose background is primarily a China background. The head of Asia in the Indian Foreign Ministry, the head of all of Asia, is also someone with a China background. China has become a career accelerator in the Indian Foreign Service, in part, I think, reflecting a desire to deepen understanding of this country. Domestically in India, my sense is, especially in the younger generation, China serves as an example of what can be done. The notion of 10% per year GDP growth, which C.K. Prahalad had pushed very strongly in India, grew in part out of his seeing what China could do. And I think that that idea is now taken as a realistic goal in India and has really been a tremendous accelerator of developments in India. So that China, in a sense, has shown what can be done by a developing Asian country. But India, and now China is India's largest trading partner. But there are concerns sufficient that India is unabashed about taking defensive measures about Chinese workers on construction projects in India and so forth. So a kind of mixed view on the economic side. There is no mixed view on the security side as far as I can see. I think Ambassador Mansingh had it pretty right, which is to say there are deep, deep worries about China's increasing presence around India's periphery. Obviously, longstanding concerns about China's very strong, what the Chinese would call an all-weather relationship with Pakistan, and the territorial issues, of course, that continue to exacerbate relations between China and India. But India and China are also sometime partners. There is now in India what is called the Copenhagen spirit in its relationship with China, reflecting the emergence of the BASIC, the group of four, on climate change issues, and also India and China and the G20 act together as often as they act somewhat differently. So this is a very complicated relationship that we're seeing develop between India and China at this point. I think as the U.S. thinks about India and China, it needs to appreciate the full array of those dimensions, because all of those are going to contribute to driving the future. Let me say, just briefly to wrap up, I think, again, I would stress, I think the Obama administration sees a strong, vibrant, democratic India as a good thing, both in itself, obviously, but also in terms of China. I mean, it's good to have strong, vibrant democracies around China's periphery, democracies that speak to each other, democracies that each do well, and that each have good relations with the United States. I don't think it's a straight balance of power notion. It's just a sense of how the region as a whole is moving, and with potentially beneficent spin-off effects for China. But as the U.S. makes policy toward India, I really don't think that our relations with China play a very large role in that. And I am quite certain that as we make policy toward China, there is very little strategic discussion of India in that policymaking process. So I think that the comment that we heard a few minutes ago is correct. The U.S. does not have an overall strategic view of Asia as a whole in which India plays a central role. Let me add, I don't think the U.S. has an overall strategic view of Asia overall at all. So, but that's always a problem when you have such wide-ranging and complex ties as we do throughout that very variegated and important region of the world. I am afraid I am not going to be here for questions. I have an 11 o'clock obligation I want to have to sneak off the stage for. So let me sit down so you can hear others, and I really appreciate having had the opportunity to make a few remarks this morning.
Thanks, Ken. Gautam.
Thank you, Ambassador Wisner, Ambassador Mansingh. Being a media person, let me begin with what we are always good at describing, atmospherics. And I think that the atmospherics of this particular strategic dialogue, the first one, have been extremely good. Let me describe what happened yesterday. I mean, the assembly at the State Department was not just august, it was the guest list was well selected. I even spoke to the ambassador from Pakistan, Hussein Haqqani, who seemed to be delighted to be there. The presence of President Obama, unexpectedly, it was only announced a day or two before the event, was also an added bonus. Now, these things count a lot. Until I woke up in the morning and I looked at the Washington Post to see whether there's any coverage at all. Well, as I said, I'm a newspaper man, so I look for these things. And I noticed that there was a tiny bit in an inside page saying, oh, Obama's going to visit India in November. And the rest of it was just two or three paragraphs of an AP copy. Now, the reason I say this is that while at the official level, there is a genuineness and a desire on the part of both the U.S. and the and of course the Indians, to have a very meaningful strategic dialogue. The public perception is different. Contrast it with what happened when the China strategic dialogue was taking place. There was enormous coverage before the event. There was coverage after the event and during the event. Television was full of it. Television absolutely ignored this particular meeting. This is something that I think a lot of us who are from India need to recognize, which is that China is sexy as far as America goes. India is, well, interesting, getting more and more interesting, but hold on, we don't have enough time for it. This is something that is not a complaint at all. This is just a description of a reality that I think Indians need to understand, that we are not the equivalent of China on the world stage at this point. I'll come back to that in a moment. Ken Liebethal said that the United States does not have a strategic view of Asia. I would say India doesn't have a strategic view of the world. India has a foreign policy which is more reactive than proactive. And there's very little by way of a document that you can produce, even like the National Security Strategy of the United States. There's no equivalent recent document that I can think of in India which lays out the way India looks at the world as it's shaping up. In a way, non-alignment was a strategic view, a position that India did take on the world. I don't agree with it, but that's a different story. It's dead. Well, sort of. And, it's certainly irrelevant as far as I'm concerned, and I think as far as the new budding relationship of the United States and India is concerned. But there is no, and in a way, and I've always been arguing for producing a strategic view, a paper which should lay out what is India's take on the world as it's developing. However, there is a counter view, which is a pretty solid, logical view, which is that India should follow Deng Xiaoping's advice of crossing the river by feeling the stones, which is that it is necessarily reactive because India lives in a very difficult neighborhood. And there are constraints of that neighborhood and therefore of India's Asian strategic view and consequently of India's world strategic view because of the reality of that neighborhood that requires a lot of reactive policymaking rather than proactive, because you really do not know much of the other side. The foreign policy that India has towards this region, Asian region, is necessarily, therefore, Janus-faced. It's essentially China and Pakistan. There's really everything else, even the so-called look east policy, which in my view is, it's not a new policy at all, it was an old policy. In fact, Nehru looked east quite a bit. Bandung was part of that Nehruvian view of look east. But it gets revived from time to time. But every time you go into the ASEAN region, and we are good trade partners with the ASEAN region, I think India's total trade volume is about 10% of the ASEAN overall trade volume, and India is the fourth largest trading partner with ASEAN countries after China, Japan, and the United States. But the moment you try to go in and expand our presence there, there's the China factor that comes in. And this is something that my conversations with people from Singapore and Indonesia in particular have convinced me, that even though that some of the Southeast Asian nations would like a stronger Indian presence, a stronger Indian role in South Asia, that is unlikely to happen. So therefore, India's strategy is essentially China and Pakistan, both, or let's say the AFPAC region, both of which have a lot of unpredictability as far as Indian foreign policy is concerned. This is a constraint that I think both the Indian foreign policy decision makers as well as the U.S. strategic thinkers have to keep in mind as built-in constraints on the immediate prospects of the relationship. The reason I say this is because the the general tendency of a lot of people, especially after the nuclear deal, is to imagine that somehow or other all that was missing in the U.S.-India relationship has somehow been blown away. And this is, again, a very popular perception that is there in India, which is why Indians keep getting surprised at the various little hitches that are coming up these days. The better approach would be to understand realistically where we stand. And I think that there are three areas where the relationship for the time being should concentrate. One is counterterrorism. It's something that concerns India and the United States, and close cooperation between the two is extremely essential. So continue the dialogue and continue the collaboration, deepen it on counterterrorism. The second, of course, is the future of Afghanistan. And this is where we are running into another problem,
yes,
which is that the U.S. has announced a withdrawal plan from Afghanistan. The problem is that it's politically necessary as far as the United States goes, but that automatically has reactions in the neighborhood. So people are readying themselves for the time, whether it actually happens in July 2011 or not, but people are readying themselves for a possible withdrawal of the United States from Afghanistan. That's an area where the U.S. and India should work closer together than they have, and I think it would be a mistake to leave India out of the loop as far as the future shape of Afghanistan is concerned. And finally, to get back to what Rajan Mittal said earlier, is that the relationship essentially should be built on, for the time being at least, on economic ties, on technology, on investment, on innovation. These are the areas where, in fact, a lot can be done. There are legal hurdles, especially in the United States, but those, I'm sure, can be overcome through dialogue. But this is the area where the relationship can develop and deepen. After all, the China-U.S. relationship also began essentially not by an overnight visit of Henry Kissinger to Beijing, but by developing through KFC and McDonald's. That's how it all began, and Boeing. And then it developed into a sound economic relationship, and that depended a lot on China's economic performance. I'll end, since I quoted the sage of American strategic visions, Henry Kissinger, I'll end by quoting him. He wrote that the world faces four major problems: terrorism, the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, the movement of the center of gravity from the Atlantic region to Asia, and the impact of a globalized economy on the world order. The U.S. and India have compatible, indeed overlapping, vital national interests in all four areas. And this is the point to remember, that it's the other billion-strong nation, not sexy right now, but shaping up, and will be not only the largest billion-strong nation in the world, but will also be a formidable economic force which shares the values, the fundamental values on which this country is based. Thank you.
Marshall. Well, since our time is, as far as I can tell, supposedly already up, and Steve has asked us to be as brief as possible, let me start by making some assertions. First, I would like to assert that a deepened, comprehensive strategic partnership between India and the United States is not only one of our interests, it is a sine qua non of continuing American global influence and preeminence over the next three or four decades. If this relationship does not move forward from where it is today, our ability, the United States' ability, to sustain even its preeminence, forget hegemony long gone, will be seriously undermined. Secondly, in order to accomplish this, we must put the security issues at the forefront of India-U.S. relations. Yes, they are the hardest issues, But that is precisely why they need to be the focus of the relationship now, not later. We do not have the luxury of pressing pause in the U.S.-India strategic partnership for one administration or two administrations or three administrations. Lying behind these assertions are a couple of general observations I would make. The multipolar world is with us. It has come on faster and in a more troublesome fashion than any of us would have expected even 5 years ago, certainly a decade ago. When our friends, Turkey and Brazil, start acting in ways that are directly counter to U.S. interests, at least in the immediate circumstance, we know we're there. We are in this more challenging environment we have long expected. Second, we now face as a nation economic constraints that will only worsen over the next two or three decades and that will in turn constrain our ability to achieve our interests without partnerships such as the one we need with India. And in fact, the greatest challenges to U.S. interests over the next two or three decades are exactly to India's immediate west and to India's immediate east. That is, the conflict and instability and challenges to U.S. interests in from North Africa to Pakistan, on the one hand, and the challenge of a changing Asia on the other hand. So we have no choice but to develop the kind of partnership that we're proposing we have with India. Why security first? First of all, I've said it is the hardest part, and it has become harder because of the need of the U.S. to engage in the way it is now with Afghanistan and Pakistan. But I would like to submit to you, there is no way we can accomplish our interests in the short term, the medium term, or the long term in Afghanistan and Pakistan without the active involvement, support, cooperation, consultation, joint decision-making with India. We are blind to that reality if we don't take it on board right now. It is precisely because the questions of India-Pakistan relations are so central to that future that we must sit down with Indians and understand how they view it, even when there are differences. It is the divergences that provide the opportunity. So let me just stop there in the interest of time, and I'd be happy to go on.
Questions? Steve, do you want to come up and moderate a couple of questions?
We're running late, but we're actually running on time because we can always push the lunch quarter hour a little bit further. But let's use this opportunity for some questions and begin with Wolf Gross right down here. And please, two things: remember to turn your cell phone on when you leave, and also please state your name and your identification. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. Wolf Gross, Northrop Grumman International. To Lalit Mansingh's eloquent establishment of the problem, if you will, which I will take the liberty of describing as a perception deficit. I think that's two words that describe what he was laying out for us. In my area, which is the one that Marshall Bouton just laid out, which is defense and security, the perception deficit is paramount. We have major statements from Secretary Gates, from the President, from Secretary Clinton, and this morning from Bill Burns, underscoring the importance of this security relationship. And maybe another metaphor is the whole thing looks to me like the lotus where the flower above the muck is so beautiful, and down below the water level, the babus, and I mean the babus on both sides, don't seem to be getting the message. What can we do to make sure that Secretary Gates's message gets down to the guy who's stamping the export license, the guy who is withholding the technology that the foreign secretary said was so important to the relationship? What I've done is laid out a problem, not asked a question, but I certainly would like the comments of the panel on this proposition.
Perhaps begin with Marshall. Did you want to?
Well, you know, it's a long story in India-U.S. relations. And I thought we were finally emerging from that era in which the U.S. military, but others in the throughout the civilian bureaucracy in Washington, both in DOD and other agencies, held on to the perception of India as kind of being on the other side. And we all know that it took a decade after the end of the Cold War to begin to, and of course the Clinton visit and then the Bush administration's initiatives to begin to wear away those entrenched attitudes. Now I fear that there is at least the potential of some of that coming back, particularly in DOD for the reasons that Wolf has laid out, because we have an extremely intense interaction between the U.S. military leadership and their Pakistani counterparts, much more limited on the Indian side, and I think it's a concern.
Thank you. Rajan Mittal?
I'm just going to pick up what Gautam had said, that in U.S. it seems that China has their sex appeal or is considered sexy. I must say here that always has a deadline. And we must realize that India is getting now not only richer, but the younger population. Between 14 and 34, there are going to be 720 million people, and that's where the consumption is going to happen. Whereas China, in that sense, is rich but aged. One-child policy is coming to hurt them very badly. So where is the consumption going to happen when we talk about Asia? It's going to be India. U.S. needs to realize that on economic velocity, I spoke in the morning also, that's where they need to engage much, much further.
Thank you. Let's see. Howard Schaefer over here.
Thank you. I'm Howard Schaefer of Georgetown University. I was much taken by Marshall's comments about the centrality, indeed the absolute necessity of a U.S.-India, post-India-U.S. security relationship in order to ensure the viability of U.S. foreign policy over the next 30 or so years. I was wondering how the two Indian members of the panel, one member, one moderator, react to that notion.
Thank you, Javi. I completely agree with you, and I agree with Marshall. This is central. You may have 18 dialogues on women's empowerment and all kinds of issues, but the security issues have to be tackled, and they are tough. What we need to do is to make sure that bureaucracies on both sides change their mindset. And this is, as you and I know, is a tough act. When I came to Washington, I was confident that I represented the strongest bureaucracy in the world. We were impregnable. But I had a healthy respect for the U.S. bureaucracy when I dealt with them. So we are being held back by obsolete rules and thinking which come down from a previous era. Now, I think, in my view, the solution would lie in somebody higher up taking charge and saying, this must be done. In other words, crack the whip. We wouldn't have got the nuclear deal if somebody, that somebody being George W. Bush, cracking the whip. We'd like to see that happen in this administration.
This gentleman over there, yeah, please.
Dr. Adityanji from Council for Strategic Affairs.
The gentleman that passed out this?
Yes.
Let me say that I really do. I mean, you're certainly free to do it, but I wish you had talked to us earlier. We'd rather have you put them there. And please keep the question very brief, since you've already made your statement.
The perception deficit is not a perception, it's a reality. It's very well reflected in Secretary Blinken's statement to Council of Foreign Relations when he talks about India being conflicted between its G77 identity and G20 identity.
Who are you asking your question to?
Question is to maybe Ambassador Wissner.
Okay, please be brief.
Okay. On the other hand, if you see from Indian civil society perspective, there's a conflict in the U.S. foreign policy establishment between its G7 identity and G20 identity. In other words, at least in Asia, the Cold War mindset still pursues, and that is why we have lack of deliverables. That is why we have lack of technology support. That is why we don't have CSLA. Commercial Satellite Launch Agreement.
We get the point.
Will the current administration,
Frank,
as a massive exercise in de-Cold Warification, disband G7 and some of the other Cold War institutions that are still shaping the mindset of U.S. foreign policy establishment?
Thank you.
Well, answer that the narrow end of that question. I don't look forward to the dissolution of existing international institutions, but I look and I feel absolutely confident you are seeing a change in priorities. This administration is pursuing its essential international economic policies in the framework of the G20. We won't go through the exercise of abolishing a G8, but the G20 and the perspectives of the G20 will drive economic thinking. Similarly, in security matters, the United States is not going to walk out of NATO. But at the same time, entering into important security relationships, understanding, sharing power, take a look at the current national security doctrine as a harbinger of where we're headed. We won't leave old institutions behind. In fact, they provide an element of strength and support. But where we're headed in the future is a much more shared and open system in which the United States is a cooperator.
Thank you. Let me apologize to people in the back because I've had eye surgery, so it's hard for me to see. But the gentleman in the way in the back in the shirt, yeah, please stand. Yeah, thank you. I think it's a gentleman, right?
Yeah, yes.
It is, definitely.
My name is Nissim Rubin. I'm the American Jewish Committee's Program Director on Indian Jewish American Relations, Building Partnerships with the Diasporas for our communities here. And my question is, you spoke about, Gautam and Ambassador Mansingh, you spoke about India's relations with Asia, the Asian continent, including West Asia and the Middle East. The India-Israel strategic relations has been quietly but rapidly growing, which helps India in its challenges as far as terrorism is concerned. Would you be able to throw some light on that, Gautam? Ambassador Mansingh?
Well, Ambassador Mansingh actually was the deputy chief of mission here when the the India-Israel relationship was formally established in 1992. In fact, I can reveal the source of the story I did for Times of India in those days. That was Ambassador Mansingh, actually. And it's a long time ago, too. So, well, I'm ready to go to prison for that. But it was a great story, and it was a relationship that began at that time in a formal sense. But today, it has gone quietly, very quietly, and which is why I also think that the U.S.-India relationship, away from the public eye, developing its quiet foundations, is not a bad idea at all, is that Israel is now one of the major defense suppliers to India, especially in high technology areas. The general attitude towards Israel in the intelligentsia is divided, let's say. A lot of it is still in the old pattern. But there is another community that's come up which is saying that, look, while you criticize Israel for several of its activities, the Israeli interests and Indian interests, there is a lot of coincidence on terrorism and on security issues. So I think that relationship is quietly going very well.
Okay. There was another gentleman in the back who had his hand up. Who was it? I guess he's disappeared. Yeah, sir. Yeah.
Some of these things like, how about expanding NATO and other weapons programs to include India? That would be win-win for both.
You mean India is a part of NATO?
Not as part of NATO, but I mean there are, NATO has been selling, kind of has strategic relations on some weapons systems and all with Australia, other countries that are outside the normal North Atlantic Treaty.
Gautam, how about making India a major non-NATO ally? Well, unfortunately, Pakistan already has it.
You remember Seattle and CENTO?
No.
Well, it actually might happen. I mean, I wouldn't be too surprised if further down the road, 5-10 years perhaps. And I think a lot depends on India's growing economic presence and the reality of India's economic quotient in the U.S.-India relationship. I think once that gets stronger and stronger, there'll be lots of things possible. It'll take a little bit of time. We are both, unfortunately, democracies.
Unfortunately. this gentleman here.
Yeah. From Business Times. During the whole week, we have been talking about strategic dialogue between U.S. and India and national security, defense, exchange control on exports and other things discussed. But the most important issue for the USA, and which President Obama has also very clearly said he wants to pick up the momentum for the US economy by promoting its exports to about $3 trillion a year for the next 5 years. And now India is viewed as an engine of growth for the US economy, and as Mr. Amit Mitra had mentioned in some meeting that there are both in the interest of India and the USA, that there has to be some technology transfer for the entrepreneurs, small and medium entrepreneurs in India. And if that situation arises, it will be a win-win situation, and we will be able to put momentum to the US economy by creating millions of jobs in America. And as Mr. Rajan Mittal has said it, India is a huge market, huge consumption, and America is looking for that market.
We'll be covering this in the next panel also.
Frank Wisner.
Oh, I'm sorry. Frank, did you want to?
I find it very hard to take issue with the notion that there is a terrific market in India and small, medium-sized enterprises have a role to play. And a very important role in both directions. I can't help but agree with you, but I think in the interest of time, we better let this question be developed the next panel.
Sure, Marshall.
Second. So I think if you step back and look at this even more broadly, one of the greatest challenges we face in the post-crisis, post-recession era, and it's going to be with us for a long time, is a fundamental question of where is global demand going to come from? The U.S. consumer is going to be going to find it harder to power. Tim Geithner, Secretary Geithner, spoke about this recently, to power the global economy as he or she has over the last 25 years. China is going to have a hard time making the transition to a consumption-led economy for a whole variety of reasons. India, while its economy is not as open as it needs to be in India's own interest, India can be a great source of global demand. That's a decision for India to make, but it is of profound interest for the United States.
Let's take one last question. This gentleman there has been very patient.
Daniel McKaley with the Council on Foreign Relations. I think that many of you have begun to make what is a very strong case that India needs to play a role in any future resolution of the situation in Afghanistan and Pakistan. But what's challenging, one of the things that's challenging for the United States is that India is reluctant to see any sort of U.S. role in negotiations between India and Pakistan, because the Indians see that as a bilateral matter and would not like to see the U.S. pressuring India in particular, which makes some sense given the terrorism and whatnot. So what I'd ask is, given India's concerns that it doesn't want to be pressured as the victim of terrorism to give concessions to Pakistan in order to advance U.S. objectives, in what ways can we engage India? And what kind of resolution might we look to in the long run that involves some sort of U.S. policy change towards Afghanistan and Pakistan that will enable us to work better with India?
You've touched a very sensitive point there, and I agree with you that it's a difficult thing. Once again, because both the U.S. and India are democracies, so everything is, washed in the open. But India did offer to train Afghan troops and policemen. That offer was not taken up for the same reason, but from the U.S. side, that would annoy Pakistan. So India is not going to have boots on the ground. That's not going to be possible. But it's not going to have even educators or teachers of police forces on the ground, because this is a complicated situation even for the U.S. and Pakistan. When it comes to the U.S. role in the India-Pakistan dispute, look, there's a U.S. role in everything. Let's face it. It's a major power, and it's the world's only superpower. It has a role. How visible should that role be? I'm sure that there's some conversation going on behind the scenes on what can be done to improve India-Pakistan relations. And as you have seen, there's a lot of progress being made, certainly from the Indian side and from the Pakistani democratic side, in my view. In fact, I would say that even the previous military regime came very close to a kind of a settlement. It was almost 90% done. It didn't work out eventually. So that is going on its own. I would say don't disturb it by, doing too much in the open.
Any of the other panelists or the co-chairs like to comment?
Well, frankly, I don't see the connection between the India-Pakistan discussions and the solution in Afghanistan. I mean, I fail to see the logic. The fact is, President Obama said there must be a regional solution. This is what he said as a candidate when he came to the White House. We haven't seen that idea being developed. And this is where India comes in. We are stakeholders. We are neighbors. Afghanistan is a fellow member of SAARC. And therefore, we would expect the United States to give us a larger role in the political settlement. And that has to be developed. And I hope that is under discussion. But the India-Pakistan relations are going on well. I think the Prime Minister has shown his confidence in the dialogue. And that's on a separate track. Let's not mix it up.
Frank, Marshall, do you want to comment?
Just 10 seconds. I would just point out that there are things that the United States should not do. it should not encourage the notion in its conversations with the government of Pakistan and particularly with the leadership of the Pakistan Army that the result of the outcome in Afghanistan should be one in which India's presence must be reduced, provided it's an appropriate presence. And I think reasonable people among the parties can agree on what that might be. But if the insistence is India has to be gone and we have to be able to have the political sway in any post-conflict resolution in Afghanistan, I mean, how can that be acknowledged? And yet there have been times in the last 18 months when we've seemed to come close to acknowledging that position on the part of the government of Pakistan.
Just a quick final comment. I'm with Lalit Mansingh in trying to keep the two sets of issues, Afghanistan, Pakistan on the one hand, and India and Pakistan as separate as possible. I believe, having watched and listened to the issue of India and Pakistan over 15, 20 years, if there is not a political willingness in the two capitals, among the political leaders and the intelligentsia, to take the chances on peace, there is no outside power that's going to be able to bridge the difference. But in the case we have before us today, the United States can play a very quiet and discreet role, and role of encouragement, of exchanging ideas privately with the parties, but in no way set itself up to be a mediator, negotiator, or public actor in trying to pressure the parties to come together. They know how to talk to one another. They've done it. And when the political circumstances in the two capitals are right, they will be back together. That's where the Prime Minister's head at the moment. On the other hand, I think we have a very important, necessary role, an active role to play on the Afghan-Pakistan front. And between India and Pakistan, the United States must make it as clear as possible the limits of the political tolerance on the two sides, to try to find ways to bridge gaps, to exchange information, to improve the basis of transparency, so there is no confusion about what either side is doing, particularly clarifying for Pakistan the extent and nature of India's presence so that that is not misinterpreted and misused. There, I think, we can play a very active and important role, encouraging the parties not only to speak to each other, but to act as the bridge where those exchanges are not now taking place.
Let me, before I thank the panelists, let me add, I guess, build on that point. I think that it's possible to see India-Pakistan cooperation in Afghanistan as perhaps an important American goal, and that this could have an implication for general India-Pakistan relations. In other words, Afghanistan is critical. It needs a Pakistani role in its settlement, and I think it does need an Indian role. And here I think all three countries have a shared interest. The alternative is failure, another civil war, India on one side, Pakistan on another side. That's some place nobody wants to go. Let me thank the panelists by saying in part that I hope the official dialogue was as good as this dialogue. If it was, and I'm heartened by the event, and thank you very much. Let's take a 10-minute break before the next panel.
Okay,
that's a problem.
Come see us sometime.
I had one different schedule.
Are you coming to India anytime?
I'm trying to come in the fall.
Are you going to do it before?
Yeah.
Before or after? The Chicago visit.
I thought before. I tried it.
Hi.
Very nice to meet you.
Yes.
Where are you based?
India.
You're in Delhi. I'm doing a lot of work in India now, out of Chennai.
What's your field?
How do you do? Nice to meet you.
Energy.
Energy.
Yes, among other things.
Sure.
I want to give you my card.
Thank you.
I'd like to come and see you because planning to write a book about India.
Please, surely.
No.
Yes.
No, nice. That's correct.
I was very interested in your comments.
This is the schedule? Okay, then
you may know one of our partners, Rush Shaker,
who is
the son of Subramanian.
Okay.
Yes, of course. Okay. Simon, how are you? Good to see you too.
Thank you very much.
Graph from your paper, the power potential. I'd welcome that. You're in math. Great.
Good.
Are you? I didn't know that. Oh, wonderful. Well,
Great, sure, I'd love to. I come to Washington once a month.
I have simple answers.
Two each month.
Americans.
I'll give you a buzz.
It's not Pakistan or America to decide. Let's ask the Afghans. Their country.
Their country. Chance to shake your hand.
And the other thing is, if India is offering to help train the Afghan national army, what prevents the Pakistanis from doing the same thing? We're not saying we are the only ones who should train them. By all means, let the Pakistanis train them. I was in Afghanistan when this was actually happening.
Yes, of course.
Some officers were going to India, some were going to Pakistan, some were going to Turkey, some were going to Britain and the United States. That's how it works. Let the Afghans decide who they want. But they can't have a veto. Who's there and who's not there in Afghanistan.
Thanks for asking me. I'm really welcome.
This is very specific. Navigate this timeline.
They're speaking in different voices. The generals are saying, let's listen to the Pakistani generals.
We want them to call them.
The politicians are saying, well, it's a point of view.
Through my students and my friends.
And your books.
To come to some sort of quick resolution, which is why they feel like they need to defer more to the Pakistan.
Okay, by all means, let the generals talk about the fighting. But
this
the
is
overall
a ficky,
policy is that of the political leadership. And does the American leadership genuinely believe that once the troops come out?
Okay.
What?
Oh, they're huge. They're hugely important. And I welcome the invitation. Let me take a look at my calendar. Oh, thank you. Thank you, Ranjana. Thank you very much. Okay. You have my card, or I'll give you my card.
Sure.
Well, it was my pleasure. Anytime I have a chance to do something with Steve Cohen and Frank Kessler, well, congratulations for doing this. It's very
exactly.
We need all the technology, and especially the timing. Actually, I think the timing and actually having it. You could have it either before or after, but it's an opportunity to say things a little more openly for government.
Very interesting. I'm glad you came. Lots of references to China.
The war with
And with nuclear weapons, you have to hit. You can't push anything great.
Which one side do you think the U.S. is focusing on? India or Pakistan? You mean? I mean, South Asia.
Yes.
Which one?
Yes.
Which one the U.S. is focusing on?
Yes, the answer is yes. Both.
Both?
Yeah.
You see, we're trying to get this article somebody else, I forgot the name of the other author, had a piece in the Times of India about 2 weeks ago, or maybe a week and a half ago, on the export controls issue. And Ken really knows these issues, as you know. And he basically said, in order for the United States to really make progress in terms of the bureaucracy and the way it acts on the issues that concern
ultimately,
we have to put India in a totally different position. We're not going to be talking about it. They have to be talking about it. They have to be in order to
see to it.
No, they're there to fight. We should have India. Why should we not have India in the same category as China in terms of...
Sure. Thank you for the overview.
Oh, that's right. So what we really have to do, but that's where the responsibility to ourselves and our own interests to make the investments now in the relationship with India, so that we have those options in the future. Well, that's the old question of whether an administration can walk and chew gum at the same time, right?
Hi.
How are you? Any time. We're always happy to partner with you. Hello.
Please take your places. We're going to start right away. Thank you.
Yeah.
So is it okay if I go on last? Because both of you, I think, will have more substantive things to say than I can key off.
Yeah, let's get started. Would you go and bring everyone to get for this panel, we decided to look at the economic relationship, but not simply in terms of economics, but also in terms of the larger U.S.-India relationship, the so-called strategic relationship. Now, so we have both strategist and economist on the panel, and to chair it, Ambassador Tom Pickering and Dr. Amit Mitra, who's the director of Director General of FICCI. And so, Tom, would you?
Yeah, Amit.
Ambassador Pickering.
You're our guest, and we afford our guests all.
No, I'll be very brief. I assure you, I'll be very brief.
Ambassador Pickering has to leave a little bit early. He has another commitment, so I'll just sit in his chair while he's after he's
gone.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Steve, and very distinguished panelists. And, of course, I'm honored to be a co-chair with such a distinguished diplomat. Let me just submit a few points for the panelists to focus on in addition to what they do. I think the first issue that the panel, we will all benefit from, is U.S.-India strategic economic engagement. We don't mean every kind of economic engagement, strategic engagement, U.S.-India. And the second element, which you could kindly look at, is U.S.-India and another part of the world in economic engagement. Within the U.S.-India, the first issue that you could look at, and we'd be benefited by that, is denial versus free flow of technology. This is a very, very important area. There is a regime that we need to look at, and I'm very happy that Mr. Gates, the Defense Secretary, recently addressed this issue. So I will not want to address it. We'd request the panelists to do that. And, of course, Ambassador Pickering could do that. Collaboration within this space of mind to market, within the technology space. FICCI has a collaboration with University of Texas and Lockheed Martin. And we are now commercializing 200 technologies of DRDO, the secretive defense organization, has opened up. So very important is how do we collaborate in the technology space, if you kindly address that. Two, hardcore defense production collaboration, what I would call buy and make. 26% equity allowed. There's a proposal I see in the newspapers, 100% equity may be allowed tomorrow. Strategic relationship in India-U.S. centers around one element, which is defense collaboration, both in terms of make and buy, and develop this from 26% to more equity. What is that about? We would love to hear the panel address that. The third internal U.S.-India is foreign direct investment flows both ways. How is that going to happen? India has invested hugely, relatively speaking, into the United States, employs 30,000 people or more, according to a wonderful FICCI study, joint study with ENY, et cetera. We'd like to know from the panelists, how does investment flow strengthen strategic relationship between the two, which happened in China in a different context? And fourth, soft power. How is, for example, in the case of health, technology has become the health driver. And my question, our question to the panelists would be, how does U.S.-India collaborate so that the common person in India is touched by America? That's what I'm calling soft power. And common person in America is touched by India. Technology in health, education, higher education we have spoken of, but technology driving vocational education. You'd be interested to know India has only 1,900 industrial training institutes, ITIs, 1,900. China has 100,000. We cannot jump to 100,000. What we can do is use American technological capability to to approach a huge number of common people as a soft power. Entertainment as a soft power. We do a conference of 2,500 people on the business of entertainment. America is the biggest participant. Whether it's gaming, whether it's animation, entertainment touches the lives of common people and therefore becomes a strategic intent. Let me also submit that I asked a Frenchman the other day, give me a name of a French. When we were young, we used to talk of Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir and all that. Today, all iconic figures of young India are Americans. That's a huge soft power. Can you give me some European iconic figures that I can talk to my young people about? They couldn't. Somebody said Levy, perhaps is. It doesn't quite match the iconic figures of the United States. So internally, these are four issues you may want to address. And externally, I would only point to two or three. One, of course, is India's engagement with the United States in Africa. We are doing a conference on the 15th of this month. Is it on the 15th? Or 16th of this month, focusing on India-U.S. collaboration in Africa. Brookings has a brilliant publication, two books on China and Africa. And I love them as great instruction for me. Where is India-U.S. in collaboration with Africa as a strategic economic partnership? That would be very useful. Number two is oil-rich nations. We both need hydrocarbon. Where is the India-U.S. strategic partnership in the hydrocarbon domain? And number three, FTAs. India is signing FTAs one after another. With Korea, with ASEAN already done, Japan about to happen, EU may happen in the future. U.S. is signing FTAs with Singapore, etc., etc. Is there a collaborative way in which foreign free trade agreements between U.S. and India, looking at those FTAs as a third-party entity? And, of course, finally, India-China-U.S. Is there a room at all? Is that competitive? Is that too sensitive? Where is the collaborative process? Do you know that in the power sector, $2.5 billion of Chinese equipment has been bought by one company in India? Those should have been American spaces, but they're not. But is there a collaborative possibility between India and U.S. in the Chinese domain? Is there one? And finally, G20. Again, globally, G20 will and should be at a much more apex level than World Bank and IMF in terms of an umbrella process. Is there a collaborative process? So my submission is only that if the panelists can address some of these in addition to their own concerns, India-U.S. internal, India-U.S. global, in that matrix, we would be highly benefited. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Mitra, very much. I come at this more from the strategic than the economic point of view, but let me do three things as briefly as I can. Look at the U.S.-India strategic relationship and the place of economics in it from the point of view first of grand strategy on a world basis. Next, on the basis of bilateral governmental relationships. And thirdly, on the business element. One can go top to bottom or bottom to top. Let me go top to bottom for a minute. The United States, in my view, has to contend with seven or eight major interrelated problem sets, only two of which are defined geographically. The most important is still basically world economic recovery, as we've seen in the last couple of weeks. This is a host of issues that are all linked, obviously, to the financial crisis. The second may well be the extended Middle East from the Mediterranean to Afghanistan, and we've just talked about India's very important relationship in that. But I suspect that India's relationship in the broader world economic issue is no less important. The third may be nuclear weapons, weapons of mass destruction, and the congeries of questions that surrounds that. The fourth may well be a question which I would define as rivals and partners, essentially countries like India, China, Russia, the EU, which is not yet a country and is not yet not a country, Japan and Brazil. And these are very important relationships, and strategically we need to learn how to deal with those in ways that are quite different than we have done traditionally, including perhaps the application of some lessons like Gor Chernomyrdin from Russia in managing the relationships. Just that's a cut above the strategic dialogue. And it's not calling a name so much as creating an operating principle. Another set of issues with which we're very much concerned from different ends of the spectrum is what I would call poverty, growth, and development. But this touches on terrorism. It touches on migration. It touches on international criminality. It touches on narcotics and a host of other questions. And then I think there's climate change, obviously, and energy. And the environmental questions are interrelated with that. And then finally, international institutions and their future. And Ambassador Mansingh raised the question of the Security Council. There's no reason at all why the United States shouldn't favor India as a new member of the Security Council. There is every reason in the world to believe that you have to live in tooth fairy land to believe that the permanent members are going to permit this to happen very quickly, or indeed that the non-permanent members who are left out are going to be overjoyed at the prospect of this change taking place. And so we can indulge ourselves a little bit, put it this way, in theory, but we have to temper that with a notion of reality. The second point I want to make is that with India's rising growth and continued expectations of high growth, the enormous opportunities there, India's growing confidence in its own economic future and its excellent management of that put the two countries in a position to be closer together in where they're going, to overall manage the trade increase which is coming out of this particular set of questions, and to understand that we approach world economic problems from a common vision rather than the disparate vision of the old past, in which we looked at it through the eyes of Adam Smith, who's been long dead, and India looked at it through the eyes of the London School of Economics, which has happily disappeared as a major power on the international economic scene. And these are important changes that are significant because they can take a less divisive role in our common overall outlook and where things are going. The third piece, and I worked for Boeing and still consult for Boeing, Truth in Advertising, is that the Boeing logement place in India has been a remarkable one. Boeing did not wake up to India until two things happened. One, India wanted to buy $100 billion worth of airplanes over 3 years. And secondly, India, the country of India, is the locus of the world's largest fighter airplane sale, in my view, in the 21st century, and maybe one of the last. And both of those awakened the eyes of an aerospace company, which had tended to look on India as being on the backside of the commercial globe and a place where little could be done. The amazing thing, of course, is that the Boeing company now understands that investment in India is more than just investment in good IT or excellent work in many other fields that India can provide. It's a real investment in its future marketing, and it's a real investment in cutting its costs, all of which are very, very important, and none of which tend to be immensely popular with the American labor unions or, indeed, with the present party in power, whose view is that foreign investment should create only jobs in America, which is not, in my view, a possible way to stretch the rubber band. However that may be, the economic basis of our relationship is growing, solid and sound. We need to talk more about these worldwide problems and how and in what way we can bring together a common vision on dealing with those. But with that, let me turn it over to the panelists to try to scrape up from the floor the pieces of wreckage we have left there as a way to begin what I hope will be a fascinating and interesting panel for you all.
Lovely, my very distinguished co-chair. I think we'll turn to Dr. Arvind Panagaria to open the panel. He's an economist, distinguished economist, whose book on India I keep on my shelf because it often serves latest book on India as a reference point, chair professor at Columbia. I request you, sir, to.
Thank you, Amit. In fact, Amit did a wonderful launch of my book about a year ago in New Delhi at FICCI. We had about...
And 200 people.
And 200 people showed up, thanks to you. okay, let me, start out a bit about, with some bit of perspective from the economic side. First of all, of course, the panel is the impact of economic ties on strategic relationship, and it is really, to me, all about economics. Had India not started growing after about, starting with the late 1980s more rapidly, and particularly in the last 7 years, super rapidly at miracle level of growth rates, none of this would have been happening. I think we know this. This is a fact. China became important precisely because it became a big economic powerhouse, and India is becoming important precisely because of that as well. Now, it is important to take stock a bit at the beginning that, you know, the fact that both India and U.S. matter to each other. For India, U.S. matters. That fact is quite obvious. It's the largest economy by far. And it's the superpower, the only superpower, and so forth. In the reverse, when you think of, you know, why India matters to the U.S., it is not as obvious. After all, India is only one and a quarter trillion economy right now, 11th ranked across the countries. So, it's, you know, it's behind, in fact, China, behind Brazil, and large number of other countries. It's 11th, after all. For India, of course, U.S. is the largest source of its, largest destination of its exports, particularly for outsourcing activities. It's a really very large market. But even for its products, merchandise trade, et cetera, it's a large market. It is the largest single destination. This is not true in the reverse. I mean, for the U.S., actually, if you look at the numbers, only 2% or less than 2% of U.S. exports go to India. Less than 2% of U.S. imports come into India, come into the United States. So why is the hype? I think this is all about, you know, looking ahead. India in the last 7 years has grown in real dollars about 11 to 12%. You know, the growth rates you get quoted are in real rupees, but when you do it in real dollars, it's about 11 to 12%. So even if you take conservatively that in the next 15 years, India would grow at something like 10% a year in real dollars, India becomes a $5 trillion economy. That actually puts it ahead of Germany. It becomes fourth largest economy in the world after the United States, China, and Japan. That really is what we are looking at. I think that's what makes India important both for the U.S. and for the global economy as a whole. And with that, I think, you know, this is where we are talking about the cooperation. And let me cover a few of the areas where I see cooperation being fruitful. Amit actually gave us a very, very broad agenda. I'd try to touch on some of those, but not all, and I'll also touch on some that he did not touch on in any substantive sort of way. First of all, I'm a trade economist, really, so I want to start off with trade. This is clearly a major area of cooperation. It's a kind of unfortunate thing that the Doha Round has dropped off the agenda of almost everybody, and particularly the United States. The current administration simply has not uttered a word about bringing Doha to conclusion. I think this is clearly in the interest of both India and the United States, and it seems to me that if there we could bring about some agreement, that's a big win-win event to, just waiting to happen. I think, you know, we were almost 90% of the way there by July 2008. There was 10 differences on 10% of the items. I think these can be sorted out, but Ron Kirk here has to make the move. This is really ball on this one. It's squarely in the court of the United States. From the second area where I think very important, actually, and both from the U.S. point of view and from the Indian point of view, is higher education. Now, when I said, you know, about the importance of India to the U.S., one big factor really is, you know, there are 100,000 Indian students studying in India today. And these are not any 100,000 students. These are some of the brightest students in the world. And these are going to be among the movers and shakers of the future. And so, you know, at any point in time, there are 100,000. And so if you build it up over a 20-year period, you're talking of something like, you know, a couple of million very, very bright individuals being trained in the United States. And I think, you know, now suddenly after a long time, I mean, there's been quite a crisis. I've been writing about this in higher education in India. Finally, some movement and some major changes actually happening. Lots of private universities are now entering in various states and so forth. And finally, India is also opening up to the foreign universities. So there is a bill already in the parliament which will open the Indian higher education market to the foreign universities. And I think, you know, this is where certainly India and U.S. have major, major gains to be had. In sort of collaboration. Apparently, it is now finally on the radar screen of the officials as well, and I hear some kind of rumblings about faculty exchange, student exchange, etc., doubling of some of these Nehru Rockefeller foundations and fellowships, etc. So that, I think, is a major area. I hope, you know, from certainly Indian point of view, but also from the U.S. point of view, simply for the fact that, you know, India is going to be ultimately the supplier of very large number of students to the U.S. universities. Even if its universities actually get better, they improve. There's no question that, you know, the number of students that are coming out would continue to be a major source of supply for the U.S. universities. Then I think, you know, where there's a lot of these strategic and economic issues come together, there are three of these areas. You got the climate change, you got energy, and you got food security. All these three are very closely interlinked areas. They are economic areas, they are strategic areas. And particularly, you know, on climate change, I think this is a big issue on both sides. Whereas for the United States, you know, the big issue is climate change, which is, you know, what might happen in the next 50 years or 100 years if we don't take action today. But for India, actually, you know, whereas the rich countries are vulnerable to climate change, countries like India are really vulnerable to climate. I mean, it is here. For India, you know, heat wave, the current wave where, you know, temperatures in New Delhi went to 47 degrees centigrade, which is like, you know, something like 116, 117 degrees Fahrenheit, you see people dying of heat waves, actually, you know, several hundred, even I have actually read in the newspapers. So the issue really of the climate vulnerability for India is a crucial one, and it's really here. And likewise, on the energy, it connects back. And ultimately, it seems to me, if you look at why there has been so little action on mitigation, it seems to me that bottom line really is that there's not enough low-cost technology around. There are some low-hanging fruits that you can actually harvest, but not enough. I mean, there isn't, even in Europe, which talks a lot more than the United States, and at least X a bit more also than the United States on the mitigation front, not enough action has happened, and it is all ties back into lack of low-cost ways to undertake mitigation. And I think that's where it seems to me there's a big scope. Now, from the Indian point of view here, it's not only mitigation issue, but it is also bringing electricity to the villages. 40% of the Indian households don't have any electricity whatsoever. So, you know, at the current levels of cost, current risks of fossil fuels causing global warming, etc., to expand electricity to even, you know, bring minimal electricity to the rural areas, to the households, is not going to happen without clean sources of energy becoming much less costly. So I think big, big scope there for collaboration. And finally, let me just take the last one. Food security ties in here ultimately, you know, I mean, once you begin to get, because ultimately if you're looking for alternative sources of energy, clean sources of energy as well, you're going into, if you go into biofuels, et cetera, you're cutting into food security as well. So ultimately, I think the technology has to provide solutions. You know, BT technology is clearly in India. We'll have to go in a big way right now. There has been a bit of a setback, actually, politically, but India needs to go into BT, GMO technologies. So that's another one. From the U.S. point of view, India is now opening up also into the retail sector. I think it will open up. Defense, Amit mentioned, will open up. Infrastructure is a big one, actually. India is going to be doing easily, you know, about $100 billion a year investment in infrastructure, and it really needs the finance. It's amazing how completely absent the U.S. infrastructure companies are from the Indian market. You hear of the, you know, Italian firms, and you hear of the French firms, you hear of the Mauritian ones, but the U.S. is largely absent from there, and I think that's where perhaps some speed work needs to be done by FICCI, actually, to educate the U.S. infrastructure firms. Finally, on the FTAs, I would say, and I've written about this over the years, that, you know, I don't think there can be an FTA between the United States and India on goods, but there can be one on services, actually. This is much less contentious, and this is where the complementarity between the two countries are. And so, you know, there is something along the lines of only services FTA to be explored. I think, you know, it'll still take a long while for it to actually happen, but that's something that could be explored. So I'll stop there. Thank you.
I think Ambassador Pickering and I would agree that you made a very important put on the table for reflection. Only one very quick point. You spoke of technology in oil and gas and so on. Let me submit one very important area of technology, which is, in fact, technology denial to us, not relating to defense and needs to be solved, is clean coal technology. United States has clean coal technology, coal gasification technology, underground coal gasification, bombardment by hydrogen and oxygen, very new technology which is commercialized in the U.S. I think one coal, strategic collaboration for mitigation will have to be coal because we will remain coal-consuming for the next 200 years, and U.S. has some synergy on that.
I'd only make one other point. On the technology side, it's easy to overlook in the fantasy, maybe the fascination is the better word, with modernization in the agricultural sector. And to me, this is the backbone still of India, of the Indian population and perhaps the Indian economy. And one wonders whether there are out there real prospects, maybe in a more complex way, for a second green revolution, or whether there are other things that need to be looked at in this context which can deal with this preeminently significant but often never heard from portion of the Indian economy.
Thank you, Ambassador Pickering. We will now move straight away to Ambassador Teresita Schaefer. She is the director of South Asia Program, Center for Strategic and International Studies. She was ambassador to Sri Lanka and American ambassador to Sri Lanka, knows this area very well. And her recent book, like Arvind's book, is again something I keep on my desk. It's : Reinventing the Partnership, U.S.-India. Delighted.
Thank you very much, both chairmen. I wanted to start with an image. I believe it was Amit who said that the iconic figures in India these days were all Americans. There is an iconic figure in the United States that is kind of abstract, but I'm going to give you a concrete version of it. I don't know how many of you noticed the Intel ads on TV. There's one that is absolutely priceless, and our visitors from India have got to see this at some point. It's an office setting. You see a bunch of people around the water cooler, and then all of a sudden the buzz goes around the room, and they've got a number of attractive young women who are all going into this swoon as if it were the Beatles walking in. And then this guy walks in, looks Indian, thick black hair, kind of looking at all these babes out of half-closed eyes. And the swoons get more swoonish. And the voiceover says, "Our rock stars aren't like your rock stars." And it's Ajay Bhatt, the inventor of the USB, the little gizmo that attaches your flash drive to your computer. I think this is part of the U.S.-India economic relationship. It's part of the U.S.-India buzz. Now, I'm going to take a long step back from the rock stars and talk about the consequences of India's economic growth and greater integration in the world in a larger strategic setting. But what I want you to do is to hold both parts of this in your brain, because I think we need to think long, and I'm going to resolutely refuse to make predictions about short periods like the next year. But we need to be aware of what it is that we have today. I see three big geopolitical consequences to India's enhanced economic growth, and I fully subscribe to whoever it was on the last panel who said that the transformation in the relationship was driven ultimately by India's economic performance. The first is enhanced Indian national power. Sanjay Baru, about 3 years ago, brought out a book which was reprints of his columns, making the argument that economic power was a critical element in India's panoply of national power. I don't think he would have made that argument 10 years earlier. That's the difference. The second is enhanced and, I would argue, transformed relationships with a number of key areas, and here I would like to mention East Asia. I actually have a slightly different view from Lalit Mansingh about what this focus on India in the Asian context means. He listed the right six issues, but the new part of it, as far as the U.S. is concerned, is the East Asia bit, which got in there in large part because the Indian Ocean bit was so important. But this was also driven by economics and is being fueled by economics. China is India's largest trading partner for goods trade. If you include services trade, it's still the United States. The three free trade areas that India has either negotiated or in the works are in Asia, ASEAN, Korea, Japan. I think it's going to be a long time before we get there with the United States, but we can talk about that later on. The third big change in India's geopolitical position resulting from expanded growth and greater integration with the world is, of course, the one that's brought you all here, the transformation of India's relations with the United States. Not only does it make the United States more important in the grand scheme of things, and this is partly a reflection of the fact that once India's economy was moving faster, this came to be seen as a critical driver of foreign policy, and therefore the economic dimension of India-U.S. relations had a lot more strategic heft in the way it was looked at, I would say both in Delhi and in Washington, than had previously been the case. But it also made India-U.S. relations far less dependent on the immediate government-to-government transactions. I know that my former colleagues who work on the never-ending litany of trade problems, one of my colleagues made the comment that nothing ever goes away. I think he's actually in the audience. But that is important. But more or less regardless of what happens with the specific trade and investment issues that we have to troubleshoot, and the list of troublesome issues tends to grow as your trade grows, there's a lot of trade that is going to expand on its own. And therefore, you have the potential of trade and investment relations serving as ballast for the U.S.-India relationship. What has the other change there, though, is twofold. First of all, the India-U.S. relationship has become instead more dependent on the policies the Indian government undertakes for its own economy, because it's the performance of the Indian economy that will, I think, to a large extent, set the scale of India-U.S. relations. And the fact that India is coming out of a much shallower slump much more quickly than the United States and other countries in the world is going to emphasize the fact that the Indian economy is part of the world's engine. The other change on the economic side has to do with some of the issues that Amit raised. The increasingly important profile of defense trade. If you're looking at this from the defense point of view, I think that Indian and U.S. officials have a different way of thinking about defense trade. For us, it's always looked on as strategic, and for India's defense policy managers, I think it's perhaps a little bit more like going shopping. But it gives increasing importance to issues of technology denial, even though we have already come a long way from the technology denials that Tom Pickering had to deal with when he was ambassador and assistant secretary and so on. What has this economic transformation meant for the way India's strategic region looks, the way India's strategic environment looks? And I'm speaking, of somewhat presumptuous of me to expound on this subject with so many greater experts in the room, but you asked me to talk, so I'm going to do it anyway. The first is the one I already mentioned. India's key strategic interests now include economics. And in this era, that doesn't mean aid. It means trade, investment, and energy. It means global growth, and especially it means uninterrupted energy markets. Secondly, the critical region runs from the Persian Gulf through China, through Japan. And that also is part of the reason that you kept hearing the word Asia in the discussion by U.S. government officials all week. Third, I would argue that India's economic growth is one of the major factors that brings U.S. and Indian interests closer together. Besides the issues I've just mentioned, trade and investment, energy, global growth, you have the importance of regional peace and security in the area that runs from the Persian Gulf through Japan. You have an interest that I think India and the United States share in the kind of equilibrium that exists among the major players in Asia. I am not shy about using the term balance of power, but I don't want to go too far in that direction, lest I be accused of seeing everything in terms of levers and fulcrums and so on. But there are a small number of major players in Asia, and I think it is in both countries' interest that China not be seen as the only one. The final point under the question of what this means for the kind of geostrategic environment has to do with global governance. We've heard a lot about the UN Security Council, and I agree with both of the points that Ambassador Pickering made. I would favor India's being invited to join. It is, in fact, going to join at the end of the year, but as a non-permanent member, I think that's reasonably clear. But I think it's probably, for reasons that go well beyond the scope of today's discussion, it's going to be a while before the package is put together that makes it possible for new countries to join the Council as permanent members. But you have India's position on the G20, which is increasingly important as a mover of global policy, and which is kind of the dream forum for India and the U.S., because it's a forum in which the discussions take place inside the room and the press is outside, so that it becomes much easier to have the kind of candid dialogue that both sides value, but which, and I think this is particularly an issue for the Indian participants, could involve irritating some friend or some constituency that they care about. We've, I think, developed a somewhat thicker skin on that. We've had a little bit longer to do it. The other observation on global governance, of course, is India's emergence as an aid donor. We've talked about Afghanistan. We've talked about Africa. India is not, other than in Afghanistan, a major aid donor. But I think there has been a conscious shifting of the persona that India represents and a conscious linking of that with India's commercial potential. Part of the presence in Africa includes Indian corporations, and in particular, India's pharmaceutical manufacturers, who were the first off the mark with affordable anti-HIV drugs. So with all this good news, what are the challenges? You knew there had to be some. The first point I would make, and it's perhaps an odd one to make here, is the China point. The challenge that India has is that China's economic profile is so much higher at this moment. China got started on its growth spurt much earlier. China's trade with the United States is about 9 times India's. That gap has not narrowed in relative terms and has grown in absolute terms in the past 5 or 10 years. Is this a problem for U.S.-India relations? Well, not really. But what it is a challenge to make sure that the attention doesn't wander. The bigger challenges, and the ones that I think are going to be with us for longer, have to do with the way India and the United States look at the countries they work closely with. Amit mentioned that the subtitle of the book I wrote on U.S.-India relations was Reinventing Partnership. The argument that I wanted to make was that neither country has a model of partnership that really fits this relationship. I think the overall India relationship, and in particular the economic dimension of it, is a challenge to India's traditional concept of strategic autonomy. On the one hand, politically, the instinct through several decades of Indian foreign policy was to avoid what George Washington referred to in another context as entangling alliances. I dislike using the word ally between India and the United States because I think it is simply inaccurate. We're not going to have a security relationship that could properly be called an alliance. But the real issue is not whether we call ourselves allies or not. The issue is to what extent are we going to be comfortable being seen in public together, dealing with those issues on which I think we can both agree that our interests converge. My expectation is that over time, we will become more comfortable with that. We will develop ways of talking about our common interests, say, in Asia. I think that may actually be starting to happen. That don't give people chilblains on either sides. And India's economic interests argue for at least selective partnership as a working model for foreign policy. On the U.S. side, there is a model of partnership, but the way it's worked in the past for the most part is that U.S. partners are much less powerful and start from a common view of a global security threat. Our relationship with India did not start from that common view of a global security threat, and we really don't have it now. We have pieces of it, but there isn't a global agreement in that sense. And so what we need to get beyond is a bit of a habit by the United States of setting out a position and expecting that the partners will more or less sort of kind of go along. Both the mechanics and the result are going to be a little bit more complicated with India. But that's what I mean by reinventing partnership. I think we are well able to do it, and I therefore, in spite of all of the roadblocks which I confidently predict we will have to deal with, I'm optimistic about the U.S.-India relationship, and I think economics will continue to be one of its drivers.
Well, I think you're summing up neither country has a model of partnership that fits each other well is a very ominous statement indeed, which we need to address. And you said something on China. Let me submit to you, when I was younger reading Marxian literature, we talked about neocolonial trade. If there is one example of neocolonial trade in the world, it is in China-India trade. Three-fourths of the trade is Chinese exports to India. The remaining one-fourth, which is India's export to China, consists of digging up iron ore and bauxite and sending it to China. So if that's not neocolonial trade, I don't know what is. And I said this in China, so I'm not saying it here. And I think there was a big debate on that. So you are right. We need to look at the tectonics of India-China trade in the future. Well, now we turn to someone on behalf of both of us, Ishwar Prasad, a senior fellow at Brookings Institution, whose reputation is widely acknowledged and known as a very, very important scholar. I request you, sir, to make your statement.
Thank you. The case for a strong economic and strategic partnership between India and the U.S. is unambiguous and compelling. I think many people in this room could make a very strong case for that proposition. What I'm going to do, in fact, is to take that veneer as given and ask about the foundations of that proposition, which I think are still a little shakier than some of us are willing to concede. Most of the relationship between India and the U.S. doesn't really play out on the bilateral front. It plays out on the multilateral front, on the global stage, as some speakers have alluded to so far. So let me talk about this relationship in three dimensions. One is the cooperation, one is the potential conflicts, and finally, India's leadership role, or whatever the role might be, on the world stage. Now, it is true that India and the U.S. share a great number of common interests. We are both very large democracies. We both rely a great deal on oil imports. India needs better banks. The U.S. needs better banks. We're all concerned about climate change, which is hurting both economies a great deal. But these are interests that ultimately don't have a clear bilateral angle to them. I think in terms of technology transfer, in terms of education transfer, clearly there are some things to be done. But these don't, to my mind, rise to the level of a major strategic set of issues. So what are the issues we can cooperate on? As one thinks about cooperation, there are certainly issues where I think bilateral cooperation will help both countries. But if I think about a benchmark, and these days, of course, China is the benchmark for everything, there is a well-defined set of issues there where I think a strategic partnership between the two countries can have significant payoffs for the two countries and the world economy. In India's case, I think the scale is much lower. Now, in terms of cooperation, clearly the two countries have an interest in achieving certain objectives, greater stability in the international monetary system. We've already talked about climate change. We've talked about issues related to the international financial institutions. And in all of these, I think India and the U.S. can play a very important role. And that, I think, is ultimately where the bilateral relationship scope is going to be defined. Now, common interests are good things in terms of defining a relationship, but conflict also tends to be a good thing in terms of defining a relationship's bounds very clearly. And here again, with the U.S.-China relationship as a benchmark, there is a clear set of discussions about the issues on the table. And again, in the context of the China, the U.S.-India relationship, these conflicts are all at a different level. India has, for better or worse, been seen as taking a position that is counter the U.S. and global interests on issues such as climate change, on issues such as trade. I don't think these are fair perceptions, but the perceptions are out there. And, of course, right now, the U.S. is not pushing very hard on either of these agendas. But in a sense, whatever conflict there was has largely been defined in terms of these issues. There have, of course, been minor irritants in the course of this relationship. The fact, for instance, that U.S. foreign firms, financial firms, had difficulty in establishing a presence in India, and vice versa, it became very difficult for Indian banks, which in some ways are in much better shape than most U.S. banks, to establish branches in India. But these I see as relatively minor irritants, although they end up, to some sense, defining the scope of the relationship. But what I think is ultimately going to matter is where India sees itself on the world stage, because ultimately I think that's what this relationship is about. Arvind has correctly pointed out that what we may be seeing in the context of this relationship is extreme foresightedness of the U.S. Now, in earlier sessions, we dumped on the Babus in both countries, and being a bit of a former Babu myself, although at an international institution, I tend to empathize a little bit with the Babus. But I think, again, one can get caught up in the gloss of this relationship and not focus exactly on what the interests are of India in this relationship, and that's what I'm going to focus on in the rest of my remarks. From India's point of view, I think there are two questions that define its relationship with the U.S. and the rest of the world by large and other bilateral relationships. First, what is in it for us? And second, are we prepared to lead? And I think on both of these issues, there is a set of important questions that have not been fully answered in the Indian context. Let's take the bilateral relationship between the U.S. and India, which clearly is a very promising step. And once again, one might ascribe it to the foresightedness of the Babus on the U.S. side, but on the Indian side, the Babus are not sure what this is about. And this is a suspicion steeped in history. The question is whether the U.S. is seeking to align itself with India in order to attain its own interests. Now, ultimately, every country is after its own interests, so this is not an unnatural presumption. But the question in Indians' authorities' minds is still, are we going to be the sacrificial lambs once we stand up and try to make the U.S. case for it? And this is a suspicion that comes up in a variety of contexts. Let's take, once again, an issue related to China. The exchange rate is a major irritant in the U.S.-China bilateral relationship. Now, of course, it's not so much the U.S. that is being hurt by Chinese currency policy, but to a large extent, other emerging markets, which are getting large inflows, which are not able to let their currencies appreciate because they would lose competitiveness relative to China. So emerging markets, in a sense, should be out there along with the U.S., perhaps asking for changes in currency policy in China. The case for that is not unambiguous, but this is what the Indians suspect the U.S. would like India to do. And this brings up a question. So if India did stand up and say, yes, China needs to change its currency policy and we are going to take the lead on behalf of other emerging markets, how many other emerging markets does one think would actually line up behind India? and how long would the U.S. actually support the Indian position rather than saying, look, the Indians are saying this, perhaps you should do this, but we have other fish to fry with China. And that is an important element. I think the suspicion needs to be gotten over. There is, in fact, a shared set of interests between the two countries. But the problem here is that we still are working in a historical context, and there is a concern in India that although we value a relationship with the U.S. may not necessarily be a friend in fair and foul times. And that, I think, is something that a dialogue is certainly going to help towards and is going to have to be addressed if we need to have India playing a very significant role. But the other bigger issue really is whether India is ready to take up a bigger role on the world stage. Now, as Arvind has pointed out, India's economy is one quarter the size of China's, and size does convey with it certain elements of power, both soft and hard. And India, I think, is not in an entirely secure position to go out and take the lead yet. But the question then again becomes, is there a benefit to India of taking the lead on these positions? Now, although you may not know it, India has, in fact, been taking a very powerful intellectual lead in the context of many G20 issues. It was an Indian who was a co-chair of the Working Group on Regulatory Reform set up by the G20 that initially set up the architecture for how we should think about regulatory reform, although, of course, we have moved on from then. There is the mutual assessment process, the map that the G20 has asked the IMF to put out. It is an Indian who is the co-chair of that group. How many of you know about that? Probably not a great number. And this is the issue. India is willing to provide the intellectual leadership, but not on the world stage. To my mind, this is not the way we should be approaching it. To my mind, as an Indian, I think there is a strong case to be made for making intellectual leadership in a more visible way. Even if we don't have new positions to put forward, I think articulating the Indian position is going to be very important. The concern, if we don't do that, is essentially that the U.S. and other countries sort of see India as a bulwark against China. And that is not a comfortable position to be in. I think India needs to stand up for itself. And perhaps what we can achieve through this bilateral relationship is some strengthening of the Indian hand, some allaying of the suspicion from the Indian side about what the U.S. wants from India, and perhaps then India will finally take its place on the world stage, because I think ultimately this bilateral relationship is going to matter only if it means that India takes a significant role in world economic matters. Thanks.
Some very, very important statements, and provocative indeed for people to raise many questions. India must take its place in the world stage, which it is not. And therefore, that's a very important challenger gauntlet you've thrown. May I request Steve to please take questions?
Okay.
Because you know the people better than I do, and that would be wonderful.
No. Yes, sir.
Hi, my name is Solomon Saul. I have a question because a little more than a decade ago, there was a mad rush by American companies to go to China and to try to, under the idea of doing free trade. Unfortunately, till today, I think we were trying to do free trade with people who are not exactly free, unfortunately. And why is that? Why do we not see that same kind of mad dash towards India, where there is protection? It is a democracy. There is protection of IP. People have recourse if there is a problem.
I would argue with your premise. I think there has been at various times a mad dash into India, and going back actually fairly far in the mid 1990s, there certainly was a period when American companies were, falling all over each other at the airports. The volume is less. India historically, I'm not going back to the days of John Company, but in independent India, foreign investment has not been a large percentage of GDP. And it's still a relatively inward-looking economy, though much more outward-looking than it used to be. But the other thing that's happening recently is that increasingly the foreign companies that come there are attracted, at least in part, by the domestic market.
Would you like to make a comment?
India is still a relatively new story. It's only last 7 years that the growth has really picked up to the miracle levels, like, you know, what I call 8 to 10% rate of growth. And as he's correct, exactly right, that there has been no mad dash by anybody in the Indian market, in the sense that, you know, still compositionally, U.S. is still the largest supplier of direct foreign investment into India. So about, it accounts for about 13, 14% of the total foreign investment into India, and it's the single largest supplier of those investments. Now, what happened in the Indian case was that the portfolio investment was much bigger, and there the U.S., of course, is very involved. The direct foreign investment really picked up in only last about 3 or 4 years. Starting about 2007-08 financial year, it's now about the level of $30-35 billion per year, which is a significant amount, and I think we'll now perhaps see a lot more rush by all the companies, including the U.S. companies.
The gentleman there? Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Unfortunately, Tom Pickering has left. I wanted to follow up on his question point about agriculture. Let me assert that Indian agricultural policy, both domestically and internationally, has been a disaster. Despite the Green Revolution, in recent years, certainly the last 20 years. First, the Green Revolution has run its course, as you all know. Yield levels in staple crops and cereals have plateaued, and some places are declining. Water scarcity is exacerbating the inherent limitations of the genetics of the first round of the Green Revolution, and so forth and so on. And Indian research has not kept pace with the need for a second Green Revolution. It's only recently, in the last, literally the last year, that the Prime Minister, particularly the Prime Minister, has recognized this. India, from the commercial side, there's some evidence of renewed interest in agriculture, but Rajan Mittal was here. Sunil tried to found a company that would create a supply chain and blah, blah, blah. It, you know, failed. Secondly, agriculture in India has always been tilted toward the urban poor. Government pays a support price, requires, especially during crises, a large amount be sold to the government for distribution, sold at below market price in the urban areas. The government makes it up to the farmers by forgiving credit, spreading money across. I'll get to the end on this, Steve. Don't worry. And we have agriculture growing at 1-2 maximum 3% a year when the industrial economy is growing at 12-14% a year. Finally, agriculture is the principal problem in terms of India's negotiating stance on Doha or any other multilateral trade liberalization. So as far as I can tell, Indian agricultural policy has been, in the last two decades, has become a failure. What can be done?
Arvind?
Yeah, this is a very, very big question, and I have a, you know, whole couple of chapters in my book on the whole sets of issues. Bottom line really is this. In the end, agriculture never grows more than, in really good times, it might grow at 4%. If you are miraculous, you might grow at 5%, but that also not for more than a decade or two. So in my thinking, the ultimate, there's a lot of reforms to be done in agriculture. Quite a bit is actually going on. Part of the problem arises because agriculture is a state subject and different states have different capacities to do their reforms. It's not something that the center can actually do in India. But nevertheless, you know, there are some reforms underway. But ultimately, the bottom line really is that it is the industrial engine which has to start kicking much harder, much stronger, in particular the labor-intensive sectors such as apparel, footwear, light consumer goods industries, et cetera, which employ much larger number of workers. Unless we have the transition of these workers out of agriculture into the industry, and maybe some of them in services, at a much more rapid pace than has been the case, you're not going to solve that problem. mean, in the end, you know, the, unfortunately, the present government is very focused on all these redistributive programs, which in the short term are a good thing. You know, soften the blow that people are facing in their lives every day. But in the end, this is the way to tie down these people into the low-level, low-income professions, rather than having them actually leave those professions and seek out better paid jobs. So there's both ways, I think, you know, trying to kind of keep the guys who are poor into these poor professions. At the same time, the industrial engine has not been kicking on much faster. Remember that India's growth has been driven largely by services. These are not necessarily just the, you know, financial sector services or high-tech services like software, but large number of informal sector services and so forth. These are not the ones that employed people at good wages, at high wages, in large numbers. You need the labor-intensive manufacturing to actually kick up. That's where the big challenge, in my opinion, is, and that requires a bit of reform of the power sector, but more importantly, of the labor markets themselves. And the big difference between India, on the one hand, and the entire East Asian set of economies is that in the East Asian economies, whether it be Taiwan, Hong Kong, Singapore, Korea, China, labor markets are incredibly flexible. In India, labor markets are most inflexible. Only 7% of India's workforce is actually employed by the organized sector in India, whether it's services or industry. So India has a big challenge doing labor market reforms. Until that happens, I think, you know, ultimately, with 3 or 4% growth in agriculture, even in good times, you're not going to make people's lives much happier, much faster.
May I ask Ashwar to perhaps compare the trajectories of Chinese agricultural reform and Indian agricultural reform? Because when the Chinese abandoned the Cultural Revolution, I think the first of the modernizations was agriculture.
1979.
So did that make a difference in where India is and where China is in terms of overall economic modernization?
I think there are two parts to it. One is how well the two countries did in agriculture, and second, how well the two countries did in moving away from agriculture. And the latter is really where China's strength has been in terms of moving a lot of people away from agriculture towards industry in particular, even though they haven't generated that much employment growth. In terms of our colleagues, Susan Collins and Barry Bosworth, that have, of course, done this analysis of productivity growth across sectors in China and India, and the general conclusion was that other than in the services sector, productivity growth, either measured as labor productivity growth or TFP growth in both agriculture and industry, has been much higher in China over the 80s, 90s, until the first half of the 2000s. But I think the real answer lies with what Arvind has referred to. It's not getting agriculture right is an important part, but I think ultimately we're going to have to think about how to make India a more modern economy with the industrial and services sectors generating jobs and providing a little more dynamism than they have.
If I may just add that this does not detract from a very serious issue of Indo-US collaboration in agriculture.
Of course.
It is one of the issues, absolutely. And there's been no progress to our knowledge of the type that we need in terms of research collaboration, in terms of extension services, which are typical of the first green revolution. So I think there is a missing gap, a missing opportunity here, where having said what you both have agreed on saying, I would say that in the strategic sense, a common person on the grassroots level in India, when they feel the impact of U.S. engagement in extension service, which happened in Punjab, which happened in Haryana, then spread to other parts of India, is a very critical missing link. And we from the track, too, must present to both the governments that this is an area which progress of this dialogue, one of the 18 dialogues, has been rather slow and needs much faster.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I want to just add to that. There's something, you know, one good news, a very small one, is that Tata actually donated $50 million to Cornell, which has a good agricultural school, and part of the mandate of that is to precisely collaborate on research in agriculture. But much more needs to happen from the Indian side. I think now, you know, we are not in the 60s mode where the U.S. was proactive coming in with the Ford Foundation, Rockefeller Foundation kind of thing. We on the Indian side have to be much more proactive in seeking that assistance, and I think we have not done a good job of that.
Gentleman in the center in the back. Thank you.
Thank you. Ernie Prieg, Manufacturers Alliance. I hope my voice holds up. My question is about a potential U.S.-India free trade agreement. Two or three comments said it may be a distant hope, may never happen. But my question is related to two current circumstances. One, of course, the U.S. has had this huge unprecedented trade deficit in recent years, went down some last year, but it's taken off again in the first quarter this year, particularly with Asia. But then it is one of the fastest growing export markets in Asia is India, of course. And yet FTAs, comprehensive FTAs, goods, services, intellectual property, et cetera, it's only the last 5 years India has been negotiating them with all our competitors, which put us at quite a competitive disadvantage. For example, the EU has always had a much larger market share in India than the U.S., maybe not individual countries, but as a group, and it's been growing the last 5 years. Now not only have the euro going down 10 to 20%, but the FTA with India, EU, was concluded. The plan is to sign it in October at the summit in Delhi. Then you had the two that were concluded recently since 06 with Singapore, South Korea, trade investments booming U.S. smaller market share. You have the Japan one getting close, as I understand, and they also have this freight corridor agreement, Mumbai, Delhi, which will mean big infrastructure trade and investment. And then you have other FTAs being negotiated with Canada, other ASEAN countries. So India, it's a whole different world, quite frankly, than a traditional Indian reps in Geneva. But all this puts the U.S. is moving very quickly to putting us at a very adverse competitive position. India, we're losing market share already. I didn't even mention China, which has moved in even without an FTA for other reasons. I would agree with the FIKI representative on the problem this presents. But for all these reasons, why is it not a mutual interest for U.S. and India to do what India has just done with the EU, is doing with Japan, is doing with Canada?
If I may respond to that, Steve. The EU, you raised the EU issue. EU would be the big FTA in terms of size. But they have two issues which we have not been able to resolve. One is the social issue of labor standards being brought into trade negotiations. And the two is climate change issues being brought into trade negotiations. As for the U.S., from FIKI, we have proposed that it is possible to look at services and goods free trade agreement with the United States over time. But agriculture is not on the cards because U.S. still subsidizes agriculture massively and has an aggressive position globally in terms of coming into our market. And the only way we can justify that is NAFTA. According to Carla Hills, who shared this with me, NAFTA was done without agriculture. And later, U.S. and Mexico signed a bilateral treaty on agriculture because Canada just simply refused to have agriculture as one of the areas. So there is some thinking that these are possibilities, but they have not yet received the kind of sanction which creates a dialogue on the subject of FTA with the United States within the pressings of services and goods. This is a future.
The gentleman over here, I'm sorry.
I just wanted to add a reality check. The U.S. Free trade agreement with Korea, which has been negotiated for some time, has been sitting on Capitol Hill unratified for how long is it now? Since before the present administration took over. We are currently in a particularly horrible political season for trade in the United States. Free trade agreements and indeed any change in trade, as Ernie knows because he's an old trade hand for even longer than I have been, requires congressional action. I think a free trade agreement is a great vision to hold out there, but let's be clear that it's a long-term vision.
This woman right here. Yeah, there'll be a microphone. It's coming.
Sudhamma Yappan, Manchester Trade. Excellent panel, great discussion. Thank you very much. Talking about agriculture, it gives a good segue to what I have to ask Dr. Panaguria. Like how Ishwar Prasad just mentioned, India should take a leadership role. And when one visible leadership role that India has taken has been in Doha negotiations, and that has not gone too well. It takes two different sides, according to me. One hand, it is like this emerging power which wants to be a force to reckon with. On the other hand, it's like a poor country. Oh, my God, we will assign with Africa. Our agriculture is so bad. We can't be in the same level as an emerging giant. So there's a big contradiction going on in India's position, and that might be the reason why the negotiations have stalled or taken the way it has gone. So could you throw some light on what India's position could have been to get the negotiations going, or how do you foresee it going from now on? Thank you.
My position on this has been that there's a bigger problem on the U.S. side. I think on the Indian side, the problem had to do with the agricultural safeguard, which I think could have been resolved, can be resolved. Amit would know more. But on the U.S. side, now apparently the U.S. is asking for much more. This is after so much agreement had happened in July 2008 in Geneva, that U.S. now wants a lot more concessions, both in services and in industrial products. So one of the sticking points, even in Geneva, actually, had been, other than the safeguard issue on the Indian side, that the U.S. was also insisting on sectoral liberalization, which was not a part of the earlier agreement, actually, the framework agreement that had been reached. So India was correct on that one. Now it is totally a different ballgame, that if anything happens, the U.S. wants far more concessions than were on the table ever. So I'm not sure, what's going to happen there. Now, this issue has been floating around, and I'll just say two sentences on about G77 versus G20 and so forth. Now, nations always have these multiple identities. It doesn't bother me that, on certain issues, we will be G77, India will be G77 issue. Then there are other issues where we can play G20. So same way that the U.S. will sometimes play G7 or G8 rather than G20. So nations have multiple identities, like immigrants. I'm an immigrant, so I have an Indian identity and I have a U.S. identity. It doesn't bother me. I think, I live with both the identities. There may be more than two, actually. But I'm not too worried on that count.
Let me just add, what really happened is that the United States and Europe and all wanted developing countries to accept what is called a Swiss formula. In other words, you will cut your import duty by this much by accepting a Swiss formula. India initially did not want it. They agreed to it. Then they said the coefficient in the formula has to be this. India accepted. So after the matter was closed, as Arvind correctly said, U.S. suddenly came back and said, now we want more. In certain sectors, in addition to the Swiss formula, you must have zero duty. For example, automobile component sector. And that's the point at which it became very difficult to pursue this matter. So I think that's where it rests today. And it can be rekindled if we can open up this lockjam of agricultural subsidy by United States, in addition, sectoral opening. So that's why it looks dead today, because there's too much on the table that developing country interests don't permit.
I think we have to end the session because we're running almost half hour late. But let me first say one thing myself, that this panel was sort of a trap. We asked the economist and others to talk about strategy. I think the lesson I learned is that the word strategy itself is being transformed, partly by globalization, partly by interpenetration of states and economies around the world. So maybe we ought to abandon strategy as an organizing principle, although Ambassador Lalit Man Singh would oppose this. I think you have to think of the relationship as a mixture of strategy and economics and other elements, and I think that's a critical. Was there an urgent? Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. Claudio? Yeah. Claudio, identify yourself.
I'm at the U.S. Trade Representative's office in defense of Ron Kirk and the rest of us. No. You're not alone. I mean, the rest of the group as well. I think it's important, and I'm not the one to deliver this message, but I would say there is another side of this argument. And I think you were getting at it at the very end of your point, and that is what's on the table or off the table. And I think from the U.S. perspective, there has been so little on the table from the rising economic powers that looking back at arguing over where things fell apart 3 years ago or 2 years ago, I think that is in history now, because the truth is that India walked away from the table as well at that time. The reality is that we're at an impasse now because there are demands from the U.S. that are not being met by the rising economic powers, and we have the realities politically here where we can't sort of be any longer a donor into the international trading system. And India is significantly still a closed market, and its WTO role reflects that, as well as the struggles we have in some of our bilateral negotiations. And I don't mean across the board, but certainly in agriculture, and in other areas. And I think somebody said, it was either in this panel or an earlier panel, that the economic relationship between the U.S. and India will be defined by India's unilateral economic reforms. We've seen that happen, and we're still waiting on some of those to happen, which is a great debate internally in India about these. We have our opinions about where we think should go, but ultimately it's about India's debates internally and how that. So thank you for giving me just a moment.